Did German soldiers who claimed they were just following orders really believe that? In a book called Soldaten on Killing, Fighting, and Dying, the secret World War II transcripts of German POWs, Zonke Neitzel and Harald Weitzer look at the previously classified conversations of captured German soldiers and provide a first-ever glimpse into what they actually thought of the war and their roles in it. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings Zonke Neitzel, who is a professor of international history at the London School of Economics, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What were you researching when you came upon these transcripts?
Well, originally I was trying to find new sources on the mentality of the German Navy. So at this time, 2001, I was trying to write a book on the German Navy, find new approaches, and I was looking for some new sources. And this was my original approach. And when I then stumbled across the book of Michael Gannon on Black May, the Battle of the Atlantic, 1943, and he published a few pages of bugging reports, and this was totally new for me. And then I followed that trace, and then, yeah, fortunately for me, I found a treasure, a big treasure.
Would it have been available to other historians?
Yeah, it would have been available to other historians in Britain and in the United States. So we have two bulks of documents, one in the National Archive in Kew Gardens in London, and these documents were released in 1996, so since 5 years they were open, and in the United States even longer, since the 70s.
Well, considering how fascinating they are, it's amazing that nobody did anything with them until now.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by the volume of the transcripts? How many pages of material did you find?
150,000 pages.
So
it's a huge amount of paper, and I was absolutely fascinated by the amount, because when I first went to the Public Record Office to look that up, what is that kind of source, I assumed, I guessed, well, I might find a small folder with 20 pages of recorded, a special recorded conversation, something like that. And then I ordered two folders, which were 700, 800 pages big. And I was really astonished, because it was just a month, just German Navy personnel, and I ordered more and more. And I said, what is that? I mean, this was really astonishing that the British and American intelligence services kept that many documents. And I think because of the sheer volume of that documents, protected itself for discovery, because it's just impossible for a single person to read it.
Well, these are not transcripts of interrogations.
No, it's the conversations of soldiers.
How were they collected?
Well, there was a complicated system at the Allied side. If a German soldier was captured, he was interrogated at the battlefront and then went through a process of screening on various levels. And at the top of the screening process was the combined detailed interrogation center, so special interrogation camps, bugging camps, where specific German prisoners and Italian prisoners, some Italian prisoners as well, were put. And they were regarded to keep military secrets, or they were regarded as a good source of information also for the mentality of the German Wehrmacht.
So they were kept in barracks that were wired.
Yeah, exactly. So the secret microphones.
Did the POWs ever suspect that they were being recorded?
We think no. If you follow the bugging reports, there's sometimes even suspicion that some people say very little. They say, well, the walls might have ears here, you have to be careful. But then they tell every story. Even they tell stories about atrocities. And another interesting thing is they were also interrogated in these camps, and there were a lot of prisoners coming back from the interrogation into their cell saying to their fellow soldiers, you know, the interrogation officer was very stupid, I just told him lies. And then he's telling the truth. So when he would have been aware that there were microphones, obviously he would have behaved differently.
And where were these interrogation camps?
There were three interrogation camps around London. So the oldest one, Trent Park, which is, by the way, now part of Middlesex University, and the end of the station of Piccadilly Line, Cock Fosters, north of London, two west of London, and one here in the United States on the East Coast, in near Washington in Maryland, Port Hunt.
So you found this treasure trove.
Yeah.
Did you start telling all of your colleagues?
Well, it was
made this amazing discovery.
Well, it was obviously it needed some time to realize what it's really about. So there's a funny story that when I first found that in November 2001, I flew back to Glasgow. I was a visiting lecturer this time in Glasgow. And I was standing in the photocopier room at this time, and I met Professor Bernard Wasserstein, who was at this time in Glasgow. He's now back in Chicago, I think. And I told him about my discovery and said, well, yeah, I find totally new type of source.
Were these all in German?
German and English, so both languages. So we had the original German and the original translation of the time. And then he said, what do you want to do with that? And I said, well, this might be a good subject for PhD thesis or so. And then he said, do you want to give it away? And then I said, he might be right. Yeah, yes. And I said, well, no, I have to work with that. I have to provide the analysis. And this was the beginning of a decade almost, of working with that material.
And coming up with a book.
Yeah.
Do you think it reveals anything about how soldiers think in any war? Do you think that if we had done something similar with Japanese POWs or former Khmer Rouge soldiers, that we would have heard similar stories? Or, for that matter, American GIs who'd been accused of going over the line in My Lai or Abu Ghraib? Yeah.
I think there's definitely a cultural difference. So people living in a different culture, and we have a few pages of bugging reports from the Japanese as well, and you can see, well, they are living in a different society. But there is, we think, a similarity, and I think we think the similarities are much bigger than we think. Yes, there are big differences between American GIs, German soldiers, and so on, but there's something what we think would describe as a general grammar of war. So the footprint, how ordinary soldiers who are conscripted into a mass army perceive war and perceive mass violence. I think that is quite similar. And if you look at the My Lai incident of Vietnam and see how these soldiers described why they killed the Vietnamese people, and if you compare this to German soldiers describing why they killed Russian civilians on the Eastern Front, this is very, very similar.
Despite the fact that it would be looked down upon in American society, and these soldiers were encouraged to commit some of these atrocities.
Exactly. So this is the difference, obviously. In the Eastern Front, there were criminal orders, and they were encouraged even to kill people. But even so, I mean, for the Wehrmacht soldiers, killing women and children was something bad. They regarded this, although there were criminal orders, as something bad, and although they did this. And so if you want to explain that, why ordinary soldiers commit war crimes, I think you have really similarities.
How do these conversations add to our understanding of what German soldiers knew of the Holocaust?
Well, we already knew that obviously all Germans could have known what was going on, probably not in every detail, but that the Jews were transported to the East and they were killed in the East. Somehow this was or could have been widely known. But there were overall against the killings. And this is, we found evidence, this is also true for the soldiers. So if a soldier told his fellow soldier, I saw a place where 10,000 Jews were killed, there was no astonishment about these stories. It was never an incident where they said, oh, I don't believe you. This can't be true. So they accepted that, and they knew that what was going on. They were probably not knowing the details. But we have also to say that the overwhelming majority of the German soldiers were not supporting the Holocaust. They were not doing anything against it, but they regarded it as something bad.
As I understand it, the German military didn't insist that you engage in an atrocity. They didn't punish you the way some other militaries might for not following orders.
Yeah, yeah.
Because especially they understood that this could cause trouble.
And especially on the Eastern Front. Yeah.
Now, did any important information of real value come to light about secret weapons or troop movements?
Oh yeah. So I mean, obviously the Allied intelligence services didn't run this operation to enable me to write this book. This was not the original intention, I have to say. The original intention was to gather information. And they regarded human beings as a very valuable source of information because human beings can't keep secrets. And so therefore, for example, the first hint concerning the V weapons, the V1, the V2, was coming from a backed conversation of March 1943. And after that, the British said, well, we must follow that line, and they sent reconnaissance airplanes to Germany. They detected the building sites and so on and so on. And so it was a very, very valuable source of information for them.
My guest is Zonka Neitzel, who with Harold Welzer has written Soldaten on Fighting, Killing, and Dying, the Secret World War II Transcripts of German POWs. Harold Welzer, Welzer is a professor of transformation
design.
What is that? How does that fit in with what you were doing here?
Well, Harald is in Germany a very famous social psychologist, and he has worked intensively on collective memory of the war and also about the Holocaust, and so he's a social psychologist.
So you felt it was necessary, you as a historian, to also talk to a psychologist, because so much of this is about the psychology of the soldiers.
Exactly.
And some of the conversations in this book are quite disturbing. Why is it that these soldiers can talk about these horrors so calmly while... to a reader, it is really upsetting.
Yeah, it's really upsetting. It's really, really horrible. I think our explanation is that the war as such creates a new frame of reference, so a new system of beliefs, of orientations. And people tend to orientate themselves on what is regarded as normal. And obviously, in war times, other things are regarded as normal. And in war times, people do kill and people do die. And so therefore, for them, and this is, I think, the new aspect, how normal even mass violence was for these soldiers. I mean, we, as you mentioned, we were upset. And even we as authors were upset when we read all these protocols and these transcripts. But the interesting thing is that it was just... very normal for them. And this is they adopted very quickly to this new frame of reference, which is different to a peacetime frame of reference.
And you talked earlier about the group mentality that affected these soldiers.
Yeah.
So since they were with other people who reinforced their thinking or said, well, I have a story like that too, it made it easier for them to accept what they had done?
I think so, because if you ask the question... how can we explain all the atrocities from the Wehrmacht in the Second World War? And one of the old explanations was, they were Nazis. So it's the impact of the ideology. And we think this is for some sense true. So for 5 to 10%, they were really ideological warriors. But the overwhelming rest is just not interested in politics and have no interpretation. And we think the core group, so the immediate social environment, what your fellow soldiers do, what your fellow soldiers regard as positive, this is much more important than a general concept of ideology.
In talking to soldiers today, they talk about the sense that their group was a family.
Exactly.
And they all wanted to help each other.
Exactly.
Are there any stories of men starting off scared and saddened by the violence and then becoming desensitized to it?
Well, I think the desensitizing process is very, very quick. So it's even the Polish campaign, people could commit any type of war crimes.
And but some of them actually talk about seeing war as fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's the category of pleasure. This is also new in our book because we, for example, the Air Force. We had, when you look on the books on the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, we can describe it from a higher level. We have all the official orders and so on. But it's still not known what the pilots thought about their operations. And this is new in the book, and you could really see sometimes they just have fun even to kill civilians. It was just a game, like an ego shooter computer game for them.
Well, in the case of the Air Force, it was done at a distance, which is the way
exactly.
Most war is done today.
Yeah.
And you did find differences between the sailors and people from the Army and people from the Air Force.
Because they fought a different war, yeah.
You tell a story of Paul, one of the prisoners, describing coming to grips with killing. What was his role in the military?
Well, this Lieutenant Pohl was a pilot, and then he described how they gunned down in the Polish campaign people, civilians, soldiers, and how he enjoyed that. And you could really, I mean, it's very early in the war. He was shot down over Britain in 1940, so there was no great period of brutalization, and he immediately enjoyed that. So you could really see his category of pleasure, and he was worried for the horses which were killed, but not for the human beings.
And he seemed to be upset that he was shot down when he had 30 more bombs to drop.
Exactly. So this was to fulfill his operation and to kill and destroy. So again, he adopted very quickly to the frame of reference of war, and he lost all the civilized behavior and attitudes behind very quickly.
One of the first conversations involves a Russian band that had been captured. What did the soldier think of that band?
Yeah, this is, again, a very interesting story, and two fellow soldiers discussing their experience in Russia, and they talked about that the Russians had only bands, and the Russian music, that then they described how lovely, how emotional the Russian music was, and then the story came back that they killed two Russian boys.
Who they thought they would spare at first.
Yeah, they were spared first, but interestingly, they combining the story of killing these two Russian boys and the story of the Russian music, and this is how everyday's chatter is. So it's nothing special for them. And they talk about Russian music. Then they tell the story. Oh yeah, we shot these two boys. They were fanatic and so on. And then they come back to the music. It's for us, it's really disturbing. It's really, we are really upset with that. But this is how people talk about war. And then we can analyze how normal these killings were.
What about killing women and children?
This was different overall. So the German soldiers regarded, they had what I would call a masculine matrix of war. So you can kill men, but if it comes to killing women and children, this is something bad. With, I have to admit, with some exceptions, if it's in coin operations, counterinsurgency operations, partisan warfare, then they were so upset that these guerrilla caused trouble that they said, well, yeah, we killed the civilians and they deserved it.
And then, of course, there's always rape in murder in war.
Yep.
Did they justify rape?
That's also interesting. We had no specific knowledge on how a individual soldier dealt with raping. And there are a lot of stories about raping, not probably about mass raping, but individual soldiers raping women in Russia, in Italy, in France. And it was more this talk, men's talk about, oh, you know, I'm such a virtual man, and I raped these women, and it was like pleasure and having fun.
What about the Blitz maidens?
Well, oh yeah, there's also an interesting story about them. So the German women who served in the signal corps of the German army, and they complained that they had sex with French people, even with black French people, and this is unbelievable. This is not German enough, and so they complained about their sexual behavior. And in the same sentence, they are telling their stories that they were going to French prostitutes and all these things. So there's obviously a difference of how a man as a soldier should behave in war and how women should behave.
And a listener wants to know how much of these stories were bravado or bragging just to fit in?
I mean, it's very hard to tell, obviously, because we try to identify the truth behind these stories. But obviously, if two young men, especially if it's on raping, there is definitely a lot of bragging in there. But for us, it was more important what was possible to express. And if these soldiers are expressing stories on raping, and even if this was not true, it's interesting that their opponents doesn't insist that this was a war crime, but they're just having fun with that. So this enables us to construct this frame, what is normal for them, what is good and what is bad.
Did any of them express remorse for what they had done?
Very, very few, I have to admit. So there are some examples of higher ranks, generals. There are some examples of people well-educated. Very few people said, we as Germans must lose the war. It's a shame what we've done. We can't win. It would be a shame if we win. It's annoying. We as Germans must put all these criminals into court. But these were very few examples, I have to admit.
Well, we do know that there were people throughout Germany who felt that way.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
it was dangerous to express that kind yeah. of opinion.
But so. even in the Wehrmacht, we had these examples. Even generals who were professional soldiers, there are some examples of people very anti-Nazi who put a clear picture together and said, this is a criminal regime. And there was even one example of a general who said, it's our guilt. We served the Wehrmacht and this was wrong.
My guest is Sonke Neitzel, S-O-N-K-E-N-E-I-T-Z-E-L, with Harald Welzer. He has written Soldaten on Fighting, Killing, and Dying, the Secret World War II Transcripts of German POWs. This book was published in Germany, wasn't it?
This was published in Germany in April last year.
Now, we've heard all sorts of stories about denial. There was an exhibit a couple of years ago where German nationalists were outraged. On the other hand, on my visits to Germany, I have a feeling that most people are just shocked that this sort of thing ever happened in their country. So how did they react to this book?
I think the overwhelming majority of the German population, even the schoolboys, school children, they know already that what was going on, and it's a knowledge which is very well shared in the German public. So this was nothing new that the Wehrmacht was a criminal institution, but I think it's always a bit different if you in a more abstract way you know this, but then if you read these transcripts line by line, this is the original words of the grandfather, so this I think this course really, it was very well received, it was a bestseller in Germany, and so it was, I think also it was a painful book for the German public to read these ordinary men what they did in the war.
You, since you speak English and German.
Yes.
What did you think about the quality of the transcripts, the translations?
That's very interesting to say. So I cooperated with the translator, and it's an American guy living in Berlin, and I live in London and Berlin as well. So we met a couple of times, and we used the original translations done by the British Intelligence Service and American Intelligence Service of the war. And I asked when we worked together, and then it was very clear that these guys who were in the monitoring room who did the translations were well-educated people, normally German Jews, who were then in Britain mainly. And when they had to translate a conversation by probably two not very well-educated German soldiers, they upgraded their conversation, so it's a more polite expression, you know. And obviously, you hear it's an old English, so it's an English which was used in the 40s, and it's also the vision of the Germans. It's inspired by some British B movies from the war. So even the English itself, it's quite interesting.
In researching the book, were you able to track down any of the people who had been POWs?
Unfortunately not, so I think I was too late for that.
Some are still alive, I'm sure.
Some could be still alive, so there were 14,000 German prisoners were bugged, but it's very, very hard to get the addresses, the postcodes of that. So we tried it in a dozen places, but the average answer we got from the relatives, oh, my father just died 2 years ago, but we were able to meet some relatives. And there's one case of a German paratrooper who was in Fort Hunt, and an Austrian journalist was able to find him and to interview him. But this is a very rare example. In the end, we are too late for that.
And in that interview, did he defend his positions in the past or find excuses for how he felt in the past?
This specific person didn't tell his fellow soldiers very interesting stories. So this was just a normal chatter about women and everyday's life. So we would have been... We tried to find, for example, a war criminal, which was also in Fort Hunt, and Fritz Svoboda. And he was really an exception because he described mass killing of Jews in that detail and his pleasure in killing these Jews. This was really an awful reading. But he died in peace near Vienna in 2004, being a gardener after the war.
Were any of these people humanized in the process?
No. So it's interesting that the British intelligence services discussed After the war in October 45, what should we do with this material? And the position of the British intelligence services was quite clear. We will not give the material to the courts and to the Nuremberg Tribunal, for example, because we want to keep the secret. There will be an next war, and we have performed so well in bugging these prisoners, and we want to keep this thing secret.
Well, what are the lessons that modern armies can learn from these events in terms of training soldiers today?
Well, you might... I think it's very difficult because obviously you might train in for the next war your own soldiers to keep the secrets. But I think if an intelligence service is well organized, and the British were very cunning, they even forged newspapers to bring German soldiers to speak. It's very, very difficult because human beings, I would say, almost can't keep a secret. If you run that business quite well, it's very difficult. And that to keep a secret.
Well, today we would not want our soldiers doing these sorts of things. In fact, Abu Ghraib was and urinating on Korans and a few other things have been great embarrassments, have caused a lot of trouble for the U.S. military. Other militaries have had similar kinds of scandals.
But it's interesting.
Wouldn't they want to avoid these sorts of things?
But it's interesting that, given the fact that also the Americans were so successful in these bugging operations, but it was a totally different approach to human intelligence than Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, because in these prisoner camps on the war, they were treated very well. And they created a very nice atmosphere that supplied them with food, with newspapers, and this created an atmosphere when they're starting to speak. And it was quite clear that if you push pressure, violence on them, they are silenced.
So in fact, that's the argument against not using torture.
If
you make friends of the person you're interrogating, that person is much more likely to open up to you.
Exactly.
So these people felt that they were in good hands.
They were really astonished how good they were treated. And even the British took them out on excursions, and they could hear the German radio, they could hear to the BBC. And all this created an atmosphere of well-being. It was not too shabby in these camps, I have to say. And this created an atmosphere which encouraged them to speak.
So were they then clever. Moved on to other camps?
Yes. So normally the average soldier was only for 2-3 weeks in these camps and then moved to their final POW camp.
Do we have any sense of how this compared to the way American GIs who were captured by the Germans were treated?
This is a very interesting question. So we know that the German Luftwaffe and the German Navy also bugged their prisoners, but near Frankfurt in Oberursel, which was after the war an American barrack. But we haven't found bugging reports. This would have been very interesting.
We need those transcripts. Yeah. If anybody knows where they are, please tell my guest, Zonka Neitzel, who, by the way, will be giving a talk at Columbia University tomorrow at 1 o'clock. That's at the International Affairs Building at 420 West 118th Street between Amsterdam and Morningside Drive on the 13th floor, room 1302. You can find the details on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Soldaten, on Fighting, Killing, and Dying, The Secret World War II Transcripts of German POWs.